Jim says we're in chapter 42 of Genesis. I love picking on Jim. He can take it, I think. If you can't take it, let me know, Jim. I'll stop it. But he is right. We are in chapter 42 tonight of the book of Genesis, picking up our story, our narrative of what's happening to Joseph. And so far, we've seen a very important kind of rise and fall and then rise again of his character arc. We've seen him as a young man being given two dreams, two visions of his family bowing down to him. He reveals that to his own family. His brothers betray him and think about killing him, but they end up selling him off to slavers going to Egypt. He's placed in charge of an officer of Egypt named Potiphar's home. He takes care of his property and all his wealth. And then we find him being lied about by Potiphar's wife and placed into prison for over 2 years, after which time his ability given by God to understand and interpret dreams is utilized by Pharaoh, king of Egypt, or the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And we find him being revealed there through those two dreams. There's going to be 7 years of feasting and of good, plentiful harvest, and then 7 years of famine. And to prepare for that, Pharaoh placed Joseph as second in command over Egypt to prepare for this great famine, this great plague that would come upon them. And then we left off in chapter 41 and verse 56 and 57. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all the countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all the land. So here in chapter 42, thinking about all the lands in which this famine was affecting, it was overseeing, was influencing, we think about Joseph's family, his brothers, his father, his mother, in which we find them in chapter 42, verse 1, coming onto the stage, if you will, and saying this. When Jacob, this is talking about Israel, the father of Joseph, saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" He said, "Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die." And before we go much further, I want to just tell you my game plan. If I can stick to it as close as I can, that would probably be preferable for you. This next section, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this series last week, is quite intensive when it comes to reading. So we're going to do our best this evening to not belabor the reading part of this particular sermon and try to hop around a little bit in the next couple of chapters to get the key themes, get the main story, the overarching narrative, and to make application through that. I would love to go with you through this text, but that's more of a class than a sermon, and I don't want to bore you too much. So what we're going to do is just hop around and talk about the highlights, and then we'll continue on. All right, so be on the lookout for us to kind of move around a bit more than we did this morning. So again, we find Jacob instructing his sons to go to Egypt and buy grain from there because they were apparently about to starve, or they were starving when it comes to this famine. They didn't have enough supplies to take care of themselves in this situation. In verse 3, so Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. Verse 4, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. This is important because we get a little glimpse into the mindset of Israel or Jacob at this point in time. He's already lost Joseph, he thinks, right? So now he's fearful that if something happens to his sons as they go to Egypt to buy grain from the Egyptians, if something were to happen, he did not want to lose absolutely every one of his sons. So what he did was he kept back Benjamin to be with him in case something did take place. And we emphasize that because it is important to the situation that will arise here in just a couple of passages. So here in verse 5, and the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold all the people of the land. And Joseph's brother came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. What's the significance of that in verse 6? Well, it was a fulfillment of the very dream that they had been told that they were going to do for him, as a stalk of grain would bow down to other stalks of grain. And this was fulfilled in this point in time. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them. And I love this. I don't know why I love this so much. It's one of those things that no doubt I probably got wrong in my head. But the next couple of chapters, I see him messing with his siblings. I see him just pranking them or something, and I love it because they think he's dead. They're guilty of killing their own brother, they think. And here he is just messing with them, as a little brother would do in this kind of situation. So it's comical almost, but it is a serious situation in their mind, but not so much to Joseph from his perspective. All right. So he recognized his brothers, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Now, I pondered about verse 8 rather just a little bit, and I didn't research it too intensively. But I will say I know historically at this time in Egypt, it was proper for someone to be clean-shaven. And whenever you see a pharaoh or a king or a boy king even, when they're entombed, they have the sarcophagus that has the chin beard. That was decorative. It was not actually their hair. They would wear that with a strap that went around their head. So when you find an Egyptian at this point in time, historically, they were clean-shaven, as opposed to the people who lived in Canaan, they would have had no doubt beards, as common the culture was. So I don't know if that would come into play here, but no doubt him being alive, him being in charge of Egypt, and him being clean-shaven all kind of lend to the fact that they don't know who this guy is, right? Verse 9, and then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them, and he said, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." So he immediately accuses his brothers of being spies. And this puts them in a position of being taken aback because they're not spies, but also gives him the power in this situation to be able to make demands of them that otherwise would not be acceptable. Okay? So he is now putting them on the defensive to be able to say things and do things with them to be able to get more information from them, but also not show his hand or tip his hand about who he really is. Again, I don't think there's too much malice involved here, thinking about what kind of person Joseph was. I think he was either messing with them, as it may be, or he was trying to, again, get that information without being too obvious. And they said, verse 10, "No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's son, and we are honest men, and your servants are not spies." Now, the honest men part, no doubt, would have made him kind of think about that for just a few moments. And he said, "No, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said, verse 13, "Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man, the land of Canaan. In fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." So now, because they have this accusation of them being spies from a foreign country, looking at the weaknesses, the defenses of the Egyptian Empire, now they've tipped their hand. Okay, we're from one father, so you are exactly who I suspected you were. Benjamin's back with dad, and there's one of us that we think is dead. So now he knows all this information about how they relate to themselves in this family dynamic. And Joseph said to them, "It is as I spoke to you, saying, 'You are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here.'" Now, if you're familiar with this account, you recognize what he wants. He wants to see his younger brother. He wants to see the brother that is not present here in this situation. But he's doing this in kind of a sideways tactic to try and, again, not reveal himself to be alive quite yet. In verse 16, Send one of you out, and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there's any truth in you or else. For the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. We put them all together in prison 3 days. Now, I would only imagine that them being placed in prison for 3 days caused them to fret and to worry and to fear for their lives, when we know that Joseph spent a longer time in prison, still remaining truthful to what God would have him to do. So looking forward to this passage a little bit in verse 18. Joseph said, the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified. We jump down here to verse 21. And they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear him. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. So we now recognize that they see this great negative thing in their life being a result of what they did to Joseph. The guilt was still present for the action that they made so many years ago. Here in verse 22, Reuben answered and said, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke through an interpreter. And he turned himself away from them and wept. And he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. Now, we're going to see at least two occasions in our context tonight in which we find Joseph leaving his brothers to go and weep in a place alone. This was no doubt an emotional event for him. He had been through a lot. He thought his brothers left him to die without remorse, without pity. And now he sees his brothers again. He's not known to them, so he has the upper hand. And yet he also recognizes that they are still riddled with this guilt of what they did before. And even Reuben here, the one that stuck up for Joseph and tried to save his life, is thinking about this event. And it gets to him. In verse 25, Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, restore every man's money to his sack, and give them provisions for the journey. And thus he did for them. He was, in a sense, messing with them. But now that they were scared, now that they were thinking that they were going to be killed by Pharaoh because of what they did to Joseph, he fills their sacks full of food, full of grain, gives them all the money they brought to buy that grain with, and sends them back on their way. Verse 26, they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sacks to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. And so he said to his brothers, my money has been restored, and there it is in my sack. And their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is this that God has done to us? Now we're going to have to kind of pause our narrative here and jump forward just a little bit for sake of time this evening. This blessing that Joseph was to them in providing the food they needed to survive for them and their entire family, their entire tribe or clan, if you want to use that phraseology here, and also not taking money from them, was a huge blessing. But they didn't know who was the one truly blessing them, because when they saw that money, they were afraid and they thought God had gone out against them because it seems like they stole this grain. That would have been, of course, a very negative thing for Pharaoh to find out that they did. Now, they did not do that, but they were still fearful. We jump forward just a little bit. The rest of this chapter is basically him explaining to, or them, the brothers explaining to Jacob or Israel the situation that took place. So it's a bit redundant for our purposes tonight. We jump forward to chapter 43, beginning in verse 1. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt. But their father said to them, go back and buy us a little food. And as we look at the next couple of verses, there's the explanation. We don't want to go back, essentially, because he said that if we can't come back unless our younger brother comes as well. And they were fearful to bring him, because if something were to happen, they were all placed in prison again, if they were all killed for stealing, quote unquote, that grain from the last time, then all the sons would be killed of Jacob and Israel. The promise that God gave for that lion to come through Judah would no longer be able to be fulfilled, and so on. So there's a fear here about going back. Eventually, what we'll find in this context is that Jacob said, just go ahead and go. Go ahead and take the younger brother and go ahead and do it. And if he dies, if they all die, he also is going to die out of grief, is the explanation there from this passage. We know that won't take place. They don't all die, and Jacob does not die, but that's the fear in their lives right now. Now, if we look forward just a little bit, and we see we have one thing I want to say. Verse 11, when they're about to go back, they know they really didn't pay for the grain last time, and now they want to go back and get more grain. So there's a recommendation made from Jacob here that when we went over this as a large group before, I didn't make the proper application. Here in verse 11, and their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man, a little balm and a little honey. And there was an article I read one time called A Little Balm and a Little Honey. And the point was, if you're going to go to talk to someone that's not your best friend and you need their help, you need their influence, don't bribe them, was not the point. But the point was, it never hurts to bring something to show that you're concerned about their well-being. A little balm, a little honey, was the application here from Israel. A little balm, a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. Take double money in your hand and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of the sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother also and arise and go back to the man. And may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother in Benjamin, for I am bereaved. I am bereaved. So they go back with double the money they should have spent on the grain they want to purchase. The money from the previous transaction, we'll kind of say that in our modern vernacular, and these gifts to try and help influence this man to be merciful to them, to bring back the family members and bring back the grain that they would need. And we look over here in verse 19, we find them coming forth to Joseph and his officers. When they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house and said, oh, sir, we indeed came down to the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came to the encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we have brought it back in our hand, and we have brought down other money in our hands to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks. So they, of course, are fearful. They're open and they're honest about the situation, and they try to make restitution for the oversight, they think, in this last transaction. Verse 23, he said, peace be to you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. Then he brought Simeon out to them. So the man brought the men. For the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys feed. And they made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, for they heard that he would eat bread there. When Joseph came home, verse 26, they brought him the present which was in their hands into the house, bowed down before him to the earth again. That took place. And he asked them about their well-being. He said, is your father well? Is the old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? And they answered, your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive. And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. He lifted up his eyes. He saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber. and wept there. Again, a second time in which we find this emotional situation overcoming him. He breaks down in tears and he does not yet reveal himself to his family members. If we look over in verse 31, he washed his face and came out, and he restrained himself and said, "Serve the bread." So they set him a place by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that's an abomination to the Hebrews. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another, and he took servings to them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was five times as many as any of theirs. So they drank and were merry with him. I would have been suspicious as to why he's so concerned about Benjamin being taken care of so much and why he had to run away real quick and go wash his face and then come back. But this situation no doubt was confusing, and it was complex to them because they were no doubt confused on why this officer of Pharaoh's house, the second in command, first of all, blessed them with that money that they did not use to buy that first set of grain, and now is feasting with them and so concerned about the family members, and it was a blessing the whole time to them without their knowledge. Chapter 44 is one of those ones that I would love to go through with you, but we're just not going to have time to do so. I'm going to get bogged down in 44. I know me well enough to know we can't camp there at all. We have to just move forward. So I would encourage you to go back and look at 44 to get more of the details, more of the context here. But the best way that I can, in my mind, rationalize what's taking place is Joseph is trying to either get more information about his family out of his brothers, or again, he's just messing with them. I can't tell what he's doing here. It's not malicious, but there is an incident in which he basically hides a cup away in one of their sacks. And when they try to leave, he accuses them of trying to steal his cups. So that's very, again, unusual for us in our context today, but he uses that as a way to communicate more with this couple, or this family, rather, that come to him for more grain. If we look over at the very end, we can get the ending of this and then move on to 45. If we look over in verse 30. "Now therefore, when I come to your servant my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen that when he sees the lad," talking about Benjamin, "it's not with us, that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant our father with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brother. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father?" He's saying, from this accusation that this guy stole the cup, I'm going to keep Benjamin back with me. He says, you cannot do that. If he doesn't come back home with us, our dad's going to die. And he says, please let me stay. Let him go back. And then chapter 45, verse 1. "Then Joseph could not restrain himself from before all those who stood by him. And he cried, 'Make everyone go out for me.' So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Does my father still live?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence." I've been afraid before, but I've never attempted to murder my own sibling thinking that they were dead. Have this man that's in charge of a kingdom appear before me twice, question me about my origin, if I'm a spy or not, or if I'm a thief or not, and then reveal himself to me to be my long-lost brother, and ask me about our father. This situation's complex, no doubt. But the emotion involved in this situation is palpable. You can sense they knew they messed up. They were guilty of this man's life. And here he is being kind to them, but also being in so much a more powerful position than them that when he made himself known, they were dismayed. No doubt they were afraid for their lives. If there was anyone in this situation who could have all of them executed, it would have been Joseph. But that wasn't his heart. That wasn't his goal. He wanted his family back and taken care of. That says a whole lot about who this man is. Here in verse 4, Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." And they came near. He said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves." What a man. The kind of grudge that he could have held on to, that could have eaten him up from the inside, that could have destroyed his righteousness, his godliness, and turned him into a villain in this situation. To kill all of his family members for retribution for what they did against him, that was his option. And yet he chose mercy and forgiveness. It reminds me of somebody. Jesus is the creator of all that we've ever experienced. He was there in creation. When he was in the garden, he knew what he was about to face. He prayed for his Father's will to be done and not his own, and therefore, when they came to arrest him unlawfully, he went with them. When they put him up for a so-called trial, he withstood it. When they brought him before Pontius, and they finally made their decree that he was to be scourged and then crucified, he went through with that. And as he hung there dying on this cross, suspended above the earth that he helped create, looking at men that he knew their hearts, knew their thoughts, knew them better than they knew themselves. If anyone could have had retribution or revenge for what he was suffering, Jesus could have held that grudge. But instead, mercy, forgiveness, and love. Joseph is a hero in my book. Therefore, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Why? For God sent me before you to preserve life. When he looked at his situation, he did not allow his own personal situation to interfere with the bigger picture. The bigger picture here was God allowed him to be in this place at this time to save life, including his own family members. That was his perspective he chose to see the world from, and has made all the difference in his life. Verse 6, "For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives in a great deliverance. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." Verse 9, "Hurry and go to get my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near to me, you and your children and your children's children, your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you." So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and all that you have seen, and you shall hurry and bring my father down here. And then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, and after that his brothers talked with him. And then Pharaoh heard about what took place, and he was happy for them, and gave him all that he requested, gave him the best part of the land, gave him provision to take care of his family, because Joseph was the kind of man that saved Pharaoh's empire, saved his nation from poverty, provided for him, and therefore he would return the favor. This was the Pharaoh before the one that rose up that didn't know his family very well, in the book of Exodus chapter 1. We're going to have to conclude our thoughts here this evening. I do want to make mention of one more thing before we close our minds off of the life of Joseph this evening. In just a couple of chapters, you'll be able to read that Israel gives his final blessings, his final instructions to his children that become the tribes of Israel that come from their future generations. And after Jacob or Israel dies, his brothers think that maybe it was all an act. They became fearful again because they thought maybe now that our father has died, now we'll get the punishment that we deserve for selling him into slavery. And he once again reassures them that this is a genuine, true act of love and mercy that he's showing to them. This is a powerful and a wonderful account of a man that, as far as it's written here in this text, is a hero. He's someone that through his proper focus and perspective on what God is trying to accomplish did not let the difficulties of situations that were around him affect him and make him lose his footing on the foundation that God would have him on which to stand. Tonight, as we think about the conclusion and the account of what we find here in Joseph's life, I want to encourage all of us to respect his example. But more importantly, see the parallel. See that we were the brethren of Jesus as mankind that sold him into slavery, that put him to death in our minds, and that he was placed in that position to redeem and to save us from the famine of this world in a spiritual sense. He is the bread of life after all. If anyone does have a need to come forward tonight to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, if you have not allowed the Savior into your life to give you that bread to sustain you through this physical world and spiritual world, why not come forward now and obey the gospel? If you are a Christian, but you have wandered away, you have rebelled against your Creator, your Lord, and you want to make things right with Him tonight, please come forward now. Stand and we sing.